Kids, listen up, because this is probably the only time you'll hear this. Maybe one more time. This is KJ, inviting you to join me for what I have dubbed November, which is very hard to pronounce, but is my word for reclaiming my writing space in November. What does that look like? It looks like me sitting down with some writing device, pen, pencil, notebook, laptop, something, every single day in November, trying to figure out what I'm writing next and getting started on whatever that is. What does that mean for you? It means I'm inviting you to join me. Head to amwriting.substack.com/s/November, which is all totally impossible to remember and which will absolutely be in the show notes, to sign up for my November journey, which is going to include write-alongs, posts, a massive Google spreadsheet for sharing and meeting up with fellow Novemberers. This is a great word, I love it. Thoughts on how hard this is, and more than you probably want to know about why I need this regroup so badly. All writers, every genre, welcome. Goals will be publicly set and hopefully met. Think NaNoWriMo, daily challenges and a stretch, but in whatever form works for you. So, this is sign up only. I don't plan to spam the whole #amwriting community with my wails of writerly distress every day for an entire month, but it's also for everyone who wants in. I hope you will join me. I don't want to go this alone.
Is it recording?
Now it's recording.
Yay!
Go ahead.
This is the part where I stare blankly at the microphone, try to remember what I'm supposed to be doing.
All right, let's start over.
Awkward pause.
I'm going to wrestle some papers.
Okay.
Now 1, 2, 3.
Hey writers, I'm Jenny Nash, and this is the #AmWriting podcast, the place where we talk about writing all the things, short things, long things, fiction, nonfiction, pitches, and proposals. Today, I'm talking about the need for a writer to be resilient over the long haul of a career, and my guest is A.S. King. A.S. King has been called one of the best YA writers working today by the New York Times Book Review, and is one of the is one of YA fiction's most decorated writers. She's the only two-time winner of the American Library Association's Michael L. Prince Award, and has won the LA Times Book Prize. In 2022, King received the ALA's Margaret A. Edwards Award for her lifetime achievement to YA literature, and in 2023, she accepted the Allen Award for Artistry, Courage, and Outstanding Contributions to YA Literature. She is at the top of her game. Her real name is Amy, and she's taught for years in MFA programs and is currently working on her PhD in creative literature. I wanted to talk to Amy because I heard from a mutual friend, Carolyn Levitt, that Amy's publisher had made a change to her promotional team just weeks before the launch of her newest book, Pick the Lock. This is a novel which one reviewer describes as a punk opera, a primal scream, and a portrait of a family buried in lies. Many of our listeners are trying to get their foot in the door with their first book or to get a career off the ground with their second or third books. And here is someone who has written 15 books, who is at the top of her game, who is a highly decorated writer and highly respected, and who still has things that don't go her way and things that go wrong. I thought a conversation about what it feels like at this stage in a career when things don't go well and what the writer does about it would be illuminating, and I sure was right. This is a fascinating conversation. Let's get to it. So hi, Amy, and welcome to the #AmWriting podcast.
Hi, Jenny. How are you doing?
I'm happy to be talking to you today. We have just so many things we want to talk about. So thanks for being here.
Thanks, really. Thanks for having me. It means a lot. It's been an eventful and interesting few months, and it's really good to be. I love podcasts. I just have to say that out loud. I've been listening. Like, I love podcasts. So I love recording podcasts as much as I love listening to podcasts. So I'm really happy to be here. Thank you.
It's true, and we're going to get into why we're talking now and what you're referring to these last 2 months of some publishing drama, which hopefully will help the listeners. What we're going to be talking about is this reality of a publisher in some way, shape, or form pulling the rug out from under a writer at the most inopportune time is basically what we're going to be getting to. And I just want to level set by saying we are not here to throw anyone under the bus. That's not our intention or purpose, and hopefully we won't have that tone about it, but we are gonna talk about that. But before we get to that, you have a new book that has just come out, which is what the inopportune timing of what happened to you was. So tell us about this new book and the summary of the book and what it is.
Okay, I can do that. The new book is called Pick the Lock. It is, it's been published, under the young adult, umbrella, but everybody has always called me crossover. So really my books are for adults and teenagers at the same time. And so this book, Pick the Lock, is about, let's see, I actually have something in front of me written. An interviewer recently asked me to describe the book in 5 words. And I said, confined. Ooh. Yeah, I know. Confined feminist punks smash patriarchy. I was like, yeah, I like that. But it's the story of Jane. She's a 16-year-old girl who just discovered 20 years of home security footage of her own life and who's been watching it late at night. And as she does this, she realizes that everything she believes about her family and her life is a lie. It's also a story of Henry, the assumed favorite boy, Jane's younger brother, who loves nature and gardening. And lucky for him, there's Milorad, a mysterious Serbian gardener who has a pet rat named Brutus. It's a story of Vernon, Jane and Henry's father, and his erratic temper, his strict rules, and decades of whining on about how he doesn't have things he wants, even though he doesn't work for any of them. And it's a story mostly, though she isn't necessarily able to define her own self. It's about Mina, lead singer of the Philadelphia-born punk band called Placenta, mother of Jane and Henry, wife to Vernon, who, when she's not touring or in the studio making a new album, is confined to a human-sized pneumatic tube system in her own home. So it's really a story about how, like, here in America, we've been encouraged to shame and devalue working and accomplished women, mothers especially. It's about how, as children, we were somehow taught that our dad working was fine, but our mom working meant that we weren't as loved as we should have been. And it's about how, when working and accomplished women are confined to a futile system, their love won't go to waste. They will use it, like Mina does, to fight society's good battles and in the end break out of the system. And so that's kind of canned, but it helps because it's hard to describe my books.
It does help. And I want to make sure we don't gloss over, you said confined to pneumatic tubes in the home. Yes. So it's like there's this surrealist element to the work. There's very unusual structures within structures and substructures in the book. It is wild. And I want to read a reviewer from Goodreads what they said about this book, because a lot of people say things like this about your work. So this person said, A.S. King is brilliant. Her mind is insane, and I'm obsessed with it. This book was wild and crazy and confusing and wonderful. So when I read that, do you feel like that's accurate?
Yeah. I mean, I think that the way that I write and, like, how I came to writing, which was in a resilience kind of space of its own and a survival space, I think all of that formed how I write, and even like trauma formed how I write. And so this book specifically, because it is so close to home, it is a large metaphor for the system I lived in, not just in the world, which I live in now, right? Yeah. Because I do. This is the system women are confined to, which is simple as the patriarchy, but then also personal systems of the patriarchy and the way that they work inside of a home and inside of a family, or don't work for that matter. I think that, and that confusion, I love when people say it's confusing, because it's not really, but it is. It's just that I'm being so honest, and so many people are used to, can I curse on this show?
Please.
So many people are used to bullshit, and it's just, bullshit is so normalized, and sort of this idea of, oh no, things are better for women, or oh no, things are good, things are great. And it's sort of like, yeah, they are. And that's true. It's better than my mom's time. Sure. But is it perfect? Absolutely not. And does this thing that I just talked about, does this sort of scorn of accomplished women or accomplished mothers or mothers who have to, go to work, does that still exist? Absolutely, it does. More, I mean, it's on the TV all the time because it's part of our political conversation at the moment, which is, you know, actually not surprising at all considering who's saying that kind of stuff. But yeah, I think it's funny, you know, I haven't been to Goodreads since April 10th, 2010, though I absolutely love people that use it. It's just, I'm sensitive. Yeah. And there was a situation there and I was like, I got to get out of here. And it's amazing, like the willpower that you can have over not looking there, but I'm thrilled. And I know there's loads of people on there. Someone told me recently that the people are saying really nice things, and I love that. And people who,
well, sorry to bring one to you. I brought one to you unannounced, but it was so great. It was, I just loved how it captured the nuance. And when you said that your books are crossover, I mean, you can tell just by listening to you, they're very sophisticated and complex explorations of realities that impact, you know, a teenager or an adult human. So,
absolutely. And I think one of the funny things about some of the people who read my books, especially if they're looking for a reason to ban my books, which they've done to pretty much all of my books, or most of my books, is that they're like, well, this isn't for teens because this word's in it, or this isn't for teens because of this. And I'm like, you are underestimating teenagers, first of all. And that's exactly what we've done for decades. Don't you remember when you were underestimated? Like, yeah. You, and also you just took the agency away from teenagers by saying this is too whatever sophisticated, let's say, for them. And that's like, no, actually, I work with young people. That's why I write. I write in a service to teenagers. And you'd be real surprised at how smart they are and how smart TikTok makes them too. How smart the internet's made them. And am I saying that they're often more emotionally intelligent than us too, because they haven't put a lid on it yet.
Yeah. Yeah. And so that space that you write in is, it's very potent. It's very powerful. And just to give listeners a sense of the voice of Jane, the protagonist, and how what she's sort of thinking and up against, would you just read the opening, just a couple pages, and I think it gives a good sense of the vibe.
Absolutely. I will read you the prologue, which is pretty short and gives you a good vibe. You're dead right. Okay, prologue. Lesson one. I do not lie to God. God, in this sense, can be whatever you want it to be, but the one thing God cannot be is a liar or a believer of lies or a perpetuator of lies or an eater of lies or a baker of lies or a bartender of lies. God, the universe, can shake up a cocktail and serve it to you, but if you need lies to survive, you must tell your own stories, add your own garnish. God will watch you from behind the bar. God will nod and smile as you eat the cherry. God knows you are imperfect. You do not. God forgives you. You do not. This is why you lie to God. And so, lesson one is easy. I am imperfect. I forgive myself. And I do not lie to God. I first learned this lesson when I was 4 years old. I have not strayed. I am humble in the light of the universe. I have earned my place. My father lies to God all the time. Today he said, God knows we tried all we could before she went into the system. She is my mother. We is him. Tried means he didn't like her the way she was. The system is how mother travels now, contained in a tidy capsule. God knows my father should not be the keeper of God's words. He is a liar and a thief. God knows. My father cannot think God's thoughts. He is a traitor and a brute. God knows. God shouldn't even be allowed in his mouth. My father's a killer. He made my mother into a fast-moving message, fed her into a tube. The message reads, I am an example of what happens when a coward lies to God. My father, God knows, our teacher, our captor, our hero. His lesson one is, the world and its seven continents overview. My lesson one is, do not lie to God.
Woo, right? I mean, that's like, what, 2 out of 400 and something pages? It's just like, boom. What a start. So obviously you can feel and hearing you read that. I mean, every story is personal, but you can feel that there's something behind this, and big emotion. Yeah. So
So here's this book. What number is it for you? Is it?
I think it's 15 or 16.
That are published. We'll talk later about ones that are not. But
yes.
So here's this book, and it's this book of your heart and soul and brain and all the things, and we've talked before in the intro about the accolades you've won and the prizes and the position that you have in the literary world, and this book comes out, and tell us what happens. It's scheduled to come out in September. We're talking here in early October of that year. What happens?
Well, okay. So a little background. When it comes to when you publish with a children's publisher, right, whether it's young adult or whether it's a picture book, honestly, all the way through, you have an extra sort of outlet in what we call the school and library department. And so the school and library department does everything from ALA, the same as adult authors have the library department as well. But school and library has this, they're incredible, frankly, like they're an incredible kind of thing. And they'll do the teachers conferences, they do, all kinds of librarian conferences, even state ones, depending on the size and whatever. And so because my second published novel won the Prince Honor, I was sort of shifted over, for good reason, into that, hey, school and library, you're going to look after this person more than publicity will say. And in a way, to me, at least, I don't think I have this wrong because I've been in here in this business for a while, but those are the two main publicity avenues. The school and library market's going to push it, say, hey, here's this new book, check it out. It's A.S. King, her. And this year I have the Prince, the Prince Gold Medal. I won alongside my contributors for the Collector's Anthology, and it's my second, and that's weird. So I'm now the only person that has two of those things. And so I'm like, here I am. I am like positioned, right? I've got the gold medal in my hand, right? Although technically it's metaphorical gold medal. But that's, I'm holding that, right? And I'm about to drop an eye-melting book. Like, this book is an eye-melter. This is fantastic. I'm thrilled about it. Here I am. I never thought I'd be in this position to release this book. Excellent. Let's go. And so I talked to my publicist early in the year, and I'm like, hey, these are the sorts of things I'm thinking about. We had chats about it, and it was great. And then the closer to the date, we were talking about a tour, I guess, maybe 2 months, 3 months out, something like that. And it was sort of like, oh, first you'll do a regional driving tour. And I was like, that's cool. I like driving, and that'd be cool. I like local stuff too, And I always wanted to drive up. I'm in Pennsylvania, so I always wanted to go up to like Connecticut and see RJ Julia in person. They once hosted me during the pandemic. There's a lot of stores that hosted me during the pandemic. I wanted to go and see in person, and to give them the fist bump and give them the nod and thank them, really. So I was like, cool. And then she changed it, or something came down from high. I don't really know how this works. But then she said, no, you're going to go on a tour. I'm like, oh, cool. So she had me choose like which sort of route to go. And I chose one. And then I didn't hear from her for a while. And again, like, I really don't want to throw anyone under the bus, because here's the thing. All kinds of things happen. This book should have come out last year, but I had a stroke last February, right, in 23. So it's sort of like, suddenly I had to, I had to go for 5 or 6 months and recover and learn how to balance again and stuff like that. So everybody has different things going on. And I also know, from what I can tell in publishing, everyone is overworked and underpaid. Everyone. But publicists are overworked and underpaid. So are editors. Actually, so is everybody. I think every single person in those houses are overworked and underpaid. So I am always somebody who gives as much, sort of leeway as I can. But only about 10 days out did we realize, because suddenly all of, like, the dates that I was going to be going, there weren't many. Suddenly it was, oh, well, this store can't have you. And then this store can't have you. And I'm like, this is weird. Why are these all disappearing? These are all stores. And this is the other thing. These are all stores I know. I know the owner of some of them, right? So it's sort of like, this is weird. And what we discovered was that for one reason or another, some of the things that we were told, we'll say more than half the things that we were told were happening were not actually happening. They were not true. And this was also something that had happened before. So we were all, the people on the team were aware of this. And suddenly it was like, technically the tour was going to be the one, like the launch that I arranged with my local independent bookstore, you know, which is Aaron's Books in Lititz, Pennsylvania. Go Aaron's Books. We'll plug them anytime, anywhere. They're amazing. But there's that. And then there was one at my local, the local library that would have been my library in my old neighborhood, like where I grew up. And then there was one in Minnesota where my editor lives. And those were the three really good, like those were the events that really worked, we'll say. The rest, we kept two. And those two we shouldn't have kept, and we canceled the rest because they weren't going to, it's impossible to launch a book or to have an event where you only have 6 days lead, you know? Yeah. And I did, we did do that in one of the stores, a 6 day lead, and it should have been canceled. I feel like it was, you know, I feel I want to have respect for the booksellers I'm going to. It's really about that. It's about like, look, I want to come to your store and sell enough books that makes you go, man, I can't wait to have A.S. King back again. And usually I do. But on this, I didn't have the opportunity to do that this time because this is what happened. And so, you know, there was a replacement situation. Everything's going well now. You know,
wait, I want to stop you just to make sure people know what you mean. Okay. That the original publicist was
removed from my team,
and
from my team.
The replacement is a new publicist, but this
correct.
Is this is now the book is happening. It's it. There's no lead time anymore.
No, and there's no like. Here's the thing. I think I went to my bookstore yesterday because I released two. I released five books this year in a way, right? But I re-released. I had two re-releases yesterday, so I went to sign those at Aaron's Books, Lititz, PA, and. But I was talking to the owners who are, you know, family to me. And, you know, Todd said to me, look, man, I'm buying for next April already. Because yeah. I said to them, I'm like, look, it's we're 2 months or we're 2 weeks out. Or actually, now we're almost 3 weeks since the release on the 22nd. And I'm like, you know, you have a little window. Now, look, people will say, look, that first week or those first weeks are really important because you want to sell a lot of copies and maybe get on the list. Look, I don't, I know what I write. I know where I am. Now, I've had best-selling moments other times, and the New York Times, we all know, is a curated list because they won't put you on there even if you do sell the book. So I've experienced that, and many of my friends did before me, so I was warned. But it's more just sort of that publicity window, you know, they have other books to move on to. I go back to the overworked, underpaid thing. I don't want to be the one that's like, knock, knock, knock. Hi, I'm still here. I don't want to be that person. Right. Yeah. But at the same time, this time I have to, because we didn't get that chance during that window as much as we really should have, especially this was a time that I put all of August aside to write articles. And I don't usually write articles, but because this book was about domestic violence and the types of things and the patriarchy and things, I really was into writing a few articles. And I did one interview and one small article, and both for blogs. And, you know, like if the right person would have pitched the right person, right, at Vanity Fair or at, you know, that's the kind of, or entertainment, you know, I've been in those places before. It's just that those pitches weren't going out.
Right. So we're not talking about a situation where a writer who has never had these things that you're talking about, tours and bookstore events and publicists helping them get land opportunities, you know, there is a entitlement sometimes with somebody who hasn't ever done this before, where they're like, well, the publisher's going to do all these things for me, right? Or I don't have to do anything. I'm just going to sit back and let them that is not what we're talking about here, right?
No, we're not, because I don't expect much as it is, because again, I've been in this for 15 books published, and it's sort of like, and everybody's different. Like Scholastic's different with me than, but every book is different too. Like my last, not my last book, but the last book, the book that hit pretty hard was about censorship. I didn't know that we were going to be in this book banning bonanza when I wrote the book, but it went through the whole process, and suddenly I was releasing it in 2022, and I was like, and I've been an intellectual freedom fighter for years and teaching young people how to vote, like when to vote, like just basically why it matters and what intellectual freedom is and why their access to information is important, blah blah blah. And so that was like, that's a publicist's dream right there. Whereas because my book is so hard to describe, my books, all of them, you know, all we can really do a lot of times is shrug and go, it's an A.S. King book, you just saddle up. Like, that's it. Like, that's all you can really do with my books. So it's hard enough to kind of get the word out and make it seem competitive in a market that, you know, that's really leaning toward romanticy and dragons, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, and the, you know, you're talking about the fact that you're not hitting bestseller lists, but these awards that you were mentioning before, you talked about the gold medal, the metaphorical, although it's an actual, you know, medal you won, and you said, I'm the only person that's won it twice. You literally mean the only person.
Correct. On earth.
On earth, right? So this level of critical acclaim, and that's why people will know your name and know your books, people in the, what you call it, the school library.
in that place.
Yeah. And then here it just is suddenly you're having to scramble. You're having to put the whole thing on your back, basically, and do whatever you can in this window of time. So I'm interested in how you made that mental shift. You know, did you let yourself be angry? Did you feel like here we are again? Like what was just that moment of realization of what you were facing?
You know, I have, I walk with PTSD. And so that is a beautiful little, and I call it like a dampener. It's terrible and wonderful at the same time. It means I'm incredible under pressure. Like if something crazy happens, an emergency happens, I will protect and get everybody out of a building. My son's the exact same. He walks with a similar PTSD. So we have this, but then like 3-4 weeks later, sometimes 3 months, 4 months later, after I'm surprised by something, like, or somebody like surprises me, I'll be like, wait a second. Like, yeah, that's bullshit, right? And then I'll get, you know, angry. So it took me about 2 weeks. Like at first I was like, huh, what? Okay. Now, first of all, I want to say something because you already said this. This is really great. Look, publishers can only do so much. You are really in charge of a lot of the publicity you have to do. And I learned that early on. Luckily I had friends in the business too, and they were able to tell me, hey, look, this works or this works. Like for me, you know, I never had much money because I was the only breadwinner in my house for a long time. And then I still am. And so it's like, I didn't have a lot of much money to put toward it. So I couldn't like hire an outside publicist, but I could do certain things, like whether it's being, you know, whatever, I don't even know, the different things for different books. But now at this point, you know, when you are somebody who's holding this medal or who's holding these sort of this acclaim, which I don't take fully seriously, partly because of the way I'm treated, the way what we're talking about,
where's the red carpet?
Right? Well, it's not so much that, but yes, in a way, like I wouldn't even know that I should have one. Like I had someone say to me recently, someone on my team say, "Oh my God, the cognitive dissonance is so, what did he say? Like frustrating or something like that." It's like, it's incredible. Like you have no idea who you are. And I'm like, no, how would I? Literally, look what just happened. Like if someone gave a crap about like, oh man, this is an eye-melting A.S. King book. She is right in her prime. This is the bomb. And her kid's going to college. Let's go there. Let's go to the fact that my kid's about to go to college. Like, and then I could really use a little bit of help. Like anything. Like, but instead it was the exact opposite. And it was like, oh, wow. Like, okay. And it, like, TMI maybe, but I was just at my therapist like an hour before. So you're catching me like post-therapy, which is wonderful. But I said to her at the 5-3 mark, I said, I said, look, man, we should just close up now because you need some time between me and the next person. And she said something that we finished up what we were talking about. And then she goes, I want to just ask you a question. And I said, yeah. And she said, do you know how many people have said that to me? And I go, what? She goes, you need a few minutes to yourself before your next client. I said, oh, like, I don't know how many. She's like, no one has ever said that to me. I have been in this business for more than 35 years. No one has ever once turned to me on their dime and said, you need 5 minutes for the next between me and the next person. And she was trying to get me to see myself. Because I've been, you know, vilified a lot and, you know, and that kind of stuff. She was like, look, people know that you're nice. I know that they do. I talk and I listen and I know people. And I'm like, oh, and so that same spirit comes into this business. I'm like, look, man, she must be overworked. She must be stressed out. They must be this. They must be that. How can I help? You know, that kind of stuff. I bring that to it because I think it's a good way to come into it. Because if you come in expecting stuff, man, not only are you going to, people will see that and that's not nice, But with this book, how did I pivot? Let's see. Yeah, I got a little angry at some point. I mean, it took me a few weeks to go, what the heck? And also to be skeptical. Like, I honestly, how do I put this? I mean, I'm 54. I've lived a very interesting life. And I don't really believe people when they say that they're going to do a thing until I see it. I have to see it. I want to see it before I believe it. But I
can I, before we leave the therapy thing, I just want to ask you a question because I've never heard the phrasing that you used where you said, I walk with PTSD and my son walks with PTSD. And I love that. Is that your words?
Yeah, that's how I put it. Yeah, I like to say it that, like, when I say I have it, it's just that, but I walk with it, meaning I walk through life with it. So it just sort of, I don't know, it seems to work better that way because it means that every single thing you deal with, whether it's, you know, people will say like, oh, well, it's like when you hear sirens, do you get freaked out? Not really, no, but like, but what, for me, the biggest, and I think from, I can't speak for my son, I can speak for myself. For me, complex PTSD is me being this nice person, and someone taking advantage of me or being mean to me. I don't think other people are like that. So I just think they're having a bad day. And somebody on the outside has to go, yo, that person's treating you like crap. And I go, really? And then like 3 months later, I'm like, oh my God, that person hated me. And this is how, you know, this is what, you know, so it takes a long time. So for me, when I say I walk with it, I just, it's more because it's not what most people categorize it as. The thing that most trips me up is this lag time on everything. Like 3 months from now, I'm going to remember something about this whole thing and I'm going to get really angry. Right? Yeah. But right now, anger is not going to help me in my situation. So
no, it's a lovely phrasing. It really struck me when you said it. And also your story about the therapist really resonates with me. I feel like I would be the second person who would say such a thing to a therapist. But so it's interesting you're talking about bringing that quality to book publicity, that quality of, well, that person's overworked or that person wasn't able to do it or they can't possibly help me in this way. And then taking it all on, we'll all do it. We'll all figure it out. I'll figure it. Like that, taking it all on yourself must be sort of exhausting.
Yeah, and confusing because at first I'm lucky for my agent and my editor, my agent especially because we had a good few talks. I'm lucky for both of them. I shouldn't say especially, but like I love my agent. But he kept saying like, "What do you want?" And I'm like, "I don't know. Can you tell me what's available? Like, what's possible at this? This hasn't happened to me before. Although technically, like I said, I was always kind of the responsibility of the school and library department versus, publicity always does some stuff. Of course they do. But a lot of times you don't see it. It's behind the scenes too. And so I like to give them the benefit of the doubt, which is what I do a lot of times, which is what's gotten me into so many crappy positions in my life, right? And so there's times where, you know, I have to be able to look at a thing and say, this was wrong. Right. And there's a point in this situation. Yep. Absolutely. Overworked, underpaid. That whole thing is real. But actually not telling the truth is wrong. And misleading someone is wrong. And if that's because, oh, man, it got away from me. Cool. Say that.
Right.
That's it. That's all. Like, especially to someone like me, because if you know me at all, like this is how I am all the time. You can be cool. You can come up to me and just be like, dude, I did not do any of the crap I said I was going to do. And I'd be like, damn, are you okay? Can I do anything to help? That's me. It's annoying. And I used to annoy my ex-husband. He used to say I was annoyingly nice. Frickin' true. And I am. And I refuse to be someone else. That doesn't mean I don't lose my shit sometimes. I do. Sometimes I, you know, absolutely, but actually not much anymore. It turns out when someone's not around poking you in the eye all the time, you don't lose your shit that much, but that's another story.
It's actually not another story, really. It is the story of the book, but your story, the question of what you want. I mean, it's so interesting because nobody knows what sells books. Right. Nobody knows what sells this book, right? This interesting, unusual, powerful, sophisticated, nuanced, complex, all the things we would say about this book. How do you know what to even say? What do you want? You know, and I'm sure you could say some off the top of your head thing, but it's just, it's such an interesting question. What do you want? Because if I could ask, I know I just interrupted you, sorry. But if I could ask that question a slightly different way. So instead of what do you want publicity wise, or what do you want us to do for you? You know, ask the publisher given this situation, blah, blah, blah. If you could answer the question, what do you want for this book? Like, what would make this book feel like it did what you wanted it to do or needed it to do? Could you answer that, I wonder?
I think yes. And like, one of the things I think I haven't said out loud, but reviewers have, the few of the reviewers that I've seen, reviews that I've seen here and there, like, I think as we talked about it, like cross-marketing was one. And that was something we talked about way back before any of this, right? I talked with my editor about it. We both knew that it we've often talked about my books and cross-marketing. I make jokes about my book, Dig, that's the other one that won the Prince Award. And I always say, oh, the adult version's available now, because adults are like, oh, I won't read YA. It's like, dude, you should read this book. Like that's the point, right? But, right. You know, they need it to be an adult version or whatever. But, so we talked about those things. But I think for me, when we're living in a world right now, and this is me really talking more about the world we're living in, not my situation, but when we're living in a world where the word narcissist is so overused in the zeitgeist, and everyone's talking about narcissism, and specifically, you know, the type of narcissistic abuse that people are finally recognizing, thank you, whoever brought this into the zeitgeist, that they're recognizing and they're seeing kind of what to do about it, and there's so many people talking about it, that this book would be on everybody's radar. That would be fantastic, because that's really what this book is about, I suppose. Because Vernon really does read exactly like he should, without ever saying that word. The word narcissist is not in this book at all. Like, it's just, you know, but I don't know. Like, that was the thing. And I finally ended up saying to my agent, like, it took me like 2 weeks to process it. And I was like, hey, you know what? I don't know what's available, so I don't know what to ask for. But, you know, one of the things I would have loved to do is write a bunch of articles that would have really resonated well, and been something that would have been something that floated around quite like loudly on the internet for a day or two, you know, because everything like that only lasts a day or two for the most part, right? Mm-hmm. But, you know, with a link to a blog, I mean, it's not a bad thing to have a blog. I love blogs, but if that's what we've got, it's not the same.
Right. So the cracking open the adult part of the crossover story for this particular book might be the answer of that's a thing you would really want for this one in particular. Does that feel right to say?
I think so. I think I'm right about that. And I think that, but I also know that, like, for years, I've often said, because I mean, the New York Times would say, well, you know, A.S. King writes crossover books. And I'd be like, see, look, can we talk to the adult division? And I used to say when I was at Little Brown, I'm like, where is the adult like publicity? They're like, oh, just a floor down. I'm like, can we not just go down a flight and have a conversation? And yet at the same time, it goes back to what I was saying. Overworked, underpaid. Everybody's in their position, but they're all really working hard. And that is the thing about publishing that always gets me, is that I've walked in and tried to be part of that team going, look, man, I know you're working really hard, but what can I do to help? And what can you do to help me do the thing? And what, you know, whatever. And it, sometimes either I'm misunderstood or it's just not available, and that's okay. Well, just to talk to you about how I pivoted, because that was your question way back before I got into therapy. The pivot for me happened before I knew, but I had a gut feeling, and I've been trusting my gut feeling a lot more since my stroke. There's just something about, it was some paranormal thing that happened with that stroke that my gut is now like in tune.
In charge.
It's crazy, right? And it might just be my age too, because 50 is magical, and 50, the older I get, the more my gut is in tune. But I realized, and I knew, like I said, we've been talking about the adult appeal for this book. So I got in touch with one of my favorite adult authors and my favorite, like an old friend, and said, hey man, this book's also for adults. What do you think? Is there any, like, what can I tap? Like, where can I go? And she was like, oh my gosh, send it to me and I'll interview you on this podcast. And I'm like, that is flipping awesome of all people. I would love that. And so I was getting that moving, and then all this information dropped. And then suddenly I wrote back to her and I was like, dude, Can you help me? This is crazy. And yeah. then she did. And that's how we got connected.
Yeah. Well, and it's interesting, this question of who a book is for. Why do you think, you mentioned some readers will say, when does the adult version come out? Why do you think some readers don't think YA is for them?
Oh, I think that's pretty simple. I mean, especially now these days, like, I mean, it's, YA is so nuanced. It's amazing. There's so many different arms of YA. And in fact, that my surrealism, like the fact that I write the way I do, wasn't being accepted by adult editors when I was querying and querying and querying and collecting like 500 rejection letters over 15 years. And so a lot of times the answer I would get was, your audience isn't going to like this. And I was like, I always wanted to write back and go like, who's my audience? And then I realized they thought it's the women's, because I'm the woman's. I'm a woman. So the women's are are my audience. So I'm limited to the women's. And I was like, well, first of all, do you not understand how raucous our brains are? Our brains, you try living the life of a woman and you tell me our brains can't handle weird shit. Seriously, go and have a baby and get back to me. Like, honest to God. Right. And so, right though, I'm not wrong. I'm not wrong.
True.
Like, no, seriously, you try bleeding out in the middle of freaking social studies class when you're in like ninth grade. Try that. You think a boner while you're at the, that's not that exciting. You try bleeding into the auditorium seat and your teacher saying you can't go to the bathroom. Like, try that. Right. So anyway, but like, so when it came to the audience, like, I think when it comes to YA work, though, first of all, this is the reason I work in service to children. This is the reason I stay in YA, because adults are encouraged to bully teenagers 24/7. We're supposed to make fun of what they like, dislike their music, make fun of their hair, make fun of their shoes, make fun of their dress, make fun of their love. Oh, that's going to end soon anyway. Be cynical. The minute you're on Facebook and you say, my 9-year-old did this, somebody's going to say, just wait till they're teenagers. The minute, you know, somebody says teenager, they roll their eyes. When I go into school, I look at the teenagers and I say, you remember when you were 4 and you fell over? Remember that? And people would go, oh my gosh, is your knee okay? I said, isn't it different when they add 10 years? When you're 14, you trip over your new big feet. And they're like, get up. We're late for the dentist. Get in the car. And that's it. And I said, that's how the world treats teenagers. Let me tell you, when I tell teenagers that, their jaws are on the floor like, holy crap, she just told us the truth. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, yeah, you know, and the reason you're so kind of devalued is because technically it's capitalism and they want you to buy shit you don't need. And that's it. It's as simple as the same reason. Like, I always ask them, like, what did Instagram make you feel like crap about today? I'm like, Instagram's incredibly concerned with my neck wrinkles this week. What about you? And they're like, and then they start telling me, they're like, acne, you know, or my car or my phone or whatever. And it's just sort of, you know, but for me, I think the reason that adults don't read young, first of all, there are adults who do read young adult work and they know, you know, they know what they like, and maybe it's genre they like, maybe it's, you know, whatever. But like, I suppose if there was a genre, or I write literary and surreal, I'd say I would go in literary, I guess, because you use the word sophisticated, which is probably spot on. But I think just basically we put down teens the minute we think we're grown up. And so then after that, anything that's for teens, we don't do, whether it's listening to Justin Bieber, that dates me because he's now like 40. But whether it's listening to K-pop or reading YA books. That said, the most popular and the most pushed and the most publicized, okay, YA books are whatever the trend is at the moment. So if it's dystopian, it's dystopian. And yet you can find loads of adults who've watched The Hunger Games, man, and read it too. So it is appealing to everybody. It's just, they have to be told it's appealing to them. And that's what publicity is for.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Well, and this book is, I just, as a person who is sort of obsessed with book structure, just really loved there's so many, there's like a play within the story, and there's this made up, well, it's a punk rock opera, but there's this made up album and this made up band, but it sort of parallels the real band. Like, it's just, there's all these just really cool things bouncing off each other and woven together. And now we're back here, and there's the lessons that you just read us, the opening. There's different sorts of lessons from different sorts of people. And it's rich, and it definitely keeps your mind engaged. Let's put it that way, which is what anybody wants in their reading experience. I think what anybody wants, but I want to not talk about what you just said, which is you've been rejected 500 times in your career, you estimate?
Oh yeah. Absolutely. I mean, I think I might be the only person that's been rejected on both sides of the Atlantic. Like, I had this one book, 'cause I lived in Ireland for, about 12 years, 10 or 12 years, somewhere in there, let's say 11, 'cause that's right in the middle. And, I was querying this one book over there, and I got rejected probably, oh, I don't know, like 100 times. And then over here, I got rejected 100 times again for the same book. But then, yeah, I have 11 books in my attic that I will never publish. I always say, if anyone publishes those after I'm dead, I'm going to come and haunt them. But, you know, they were practice books. You know, there's a lot of us have practice books, and that's okay. When you're doing them, they are like the book of your heart, and you're like, no, this is the one. But there is a point where if you just keep writing the next book, right? But yeah, 500 times. I actually say that if you're not getting rejected, you're not working. And so I still submit a poem or a story to places, like especially the New Yorker. That's always a definite for me, because I haven't. And I'll get a rejection letter, you know, once a year just to make sure I'm working.
Oh, that's amazing. So to what do you attribute this creative resilience? I know there's other kinds of resilience that you've had to have in your life, but this particular kind of resilience of knowing that what you're producing is commercially viable, I guess, is the question, right? Where does that resilience come from?
Well, I mean, that's the funny part, commercial. I mean, especially with what I write, right? So when I first got my first agent, he actually wrote back to me on my birthday. And he wrote, I was in Ireland at the time, not living there, but I was visiting. And he wrote, I really liked this book, but I'm not a nonprofit agent. Ooh, that burned me. 'Cause that's my eighth novel. I was like, ooh, friend. So I wrote back, I'm like, listen, I am not a nonprofit author. I got seven more of these things. And he wrote back and he said, are any of them commercially viable? That's exactly what he said. And I said, I think maybe two of them. I'm not sure. And so I sent him six and seven, and he already had eight. Eight never sold. Seven was my first published book. And that was the one he said he couldn't pitch. He's like, I don't know how to pitch this. This is too weird. I'm like, I appreciate that. And then he made me fix a few things, which was funny because my editor, when we sold it, made me switch him back, but it still improved the book. So I don't care, right? I don't care that he made me. He's like, you have to, I can't even pitch this without this. You know, this guy has to die. I'm like, I don't like that. I don't think that's right. But I fixed it anyway. And I made the guy die. And that made me change. I had to change the main character, you know, and all this stuff. And that fixing, that revision, even though I changed the end in the end for my editor and me, really, really improved the book. So, you know, even those little things are worth it. But it was two things. First of all, I think most writers will say this. I can't not write. Yeah. I can't not write. I can't. I love it. And once you get the buzz of finishing a novel, even if it's garbage, like, you should see my first novel. I wish I was hoping to find it and pull it out for you, because it is on like eight different kinds of paper. It was typewritten. And it was, you could tell I was in a complete frenzy because there were no margins, not top, bottom, not right, left, none. The words just run right off the page, and I would hit the return. It was all single spaced, and it was hand numbered with different colored, like magic markers. Like, I was like 24. But I was really, once I finished it, I was so stoked. And then I had to go through those, you know, you have to go through just learning. But I really thought each one was publishable, and it wasn't, and that's okay. And now I'm here going, oh, and I had a young person, an aspiring writer, write to me and ask me, well, wait a second. I just answered it this morning. Wait a second. You said you had some novels. I did a keynote this weekend. You have a bunch of novels in your attic. Well, why don't you pull them out and revise them? Like, why don't you fix them? And like, you said they're crap. Well, what does that mean? Why don't you fix the crap? Why don't you make it better? And I was like, I started to write the letter back today, and I was like, all right, first of all, no, like my writing's so much better now than those first, you know, six novels and even a few, you know, that ended up in there in the middle. Those it's just better. I said, I don't want to publish those novels. I have a reputation, right, as well. I don't want to let my fans down. But even the premises weren't quite all the way baked. And, you know, and then in the end, I just said to her, you know, revision is my favorite thing in the whole world. And I'm really good at it. Like if you understood my process, you'd think I was insane, but it's what produces this kind of work, and it's standalone work, right? So I keep doing it. It's frustrating and it's beautiful all at the same time. I hate it and I love it. But I was like, look, when I said it was crap, I meant it. I used to be a self-sufficient farmer. I used to have to age, you know, the horse shit or the cow shit, you know, three years before it was organic and all this. And there's some times where crap is good on my vegetables and in the soil. That's great. But as a book, you can add as much sugar to crap as you want, and it's still crap. Like I'm not going to rewrite those books. I said, I'm a reviser. I'm not a magician. And I just, in the end, she said she was really just desperate for an answer to figure out like what she should do with the book in front of her. And I was like, write another book. Because you know what? If the book in front of you is as great as you think it is, then it'll sell later. It's not a big deal. And if you get the thing that you want, which is a career in writing, guess what everybody's going to want from you? More books. So you can never lose ever by writing in the next book. You can never lose. It just isn't a thing. You will always win writing the next book. That's how I feel anyway.
And have you always felt that way, or have you come to that?
I always felt that way in the beginning when I was getting rejected a lot, though there were times I was like, I'm out. And I went and I wrote poetry and I paint and I do other things. You know, I do a lot of things with my hands, art, weaving, whatever, making quilts from the early days. But I think I've always felt that way. I mean, I'm doing it now with painting. I got the second canvas on the easel and I'm like, oh boy, there's going to be 20 of these. Oh crap. Well, you know, that's cool. It'll keep me busy while I'm doing my dissertation or something else, that I'm taking a brain break, because this book really wrung me out. And I know I have to write, I have a book that's kind of, I don't really plot, but kind of semi-plotted out on the wall.
Yeah.
That I have to write in the beginning of the year. So I have a few months, but yeah. Sorry, I completely forgot your question, Jenny.
I think I was asking about that philosophy of write another book, yeah, and there's going to be another book, and it's all in service of the bigger vision, which is a beautiful advice to leave our listeners with, I think.
Yeah, you know, it's true. I mean, it's what everybody wants from you, and it's what you want from you. And that idea that, and this is the other thing I wrote to her. So just if we're going to get into this, I said to her, look, like I teach in MFA programs. And so I've met a lot of people's like novels of the heart. They bring them in. They're like, here it is. It's my baby. Yeah. And you're like, oh my gosh, you have been working on this for 10 years and it shows. I can't touch this thing. It'll shatter if I touch it. And I don't know how to say that to a person in a way, because they don't know until they write the next thing, you know? And the next thing might be like terrible because they're giving up on the novel of their heart. That's what happened to me anyway. The next two were terrible. But the idea is that if you keep writing, like I said, you can't lose, because either you're going to get better.
Yeah.
And if and keep getting better. So right there, there's your avenue. And the other one is that, look, if you're excellent right now and it's just the publishing business isn't fair to you, or you haven't found the space yet and whatever, well, cool. You got a whole backlist to publish then. Everything's going to be great. You know, it's like you've got five books then, if that's the case. So it's absolutely, it's the answer to everything in writing. I was just talking to a friend right before I got on the phone, and he's like, I'm kind of stuck. And I'm like, what are you stuck at? He's like, I don't know. I'm doing this to myself. I'm like, yeah, you are. And I said, you know, write something. If it's an essay, if it's a poem, I don't care what it is. Just write something. That's what writers do. That's what writers do. We write.
Beautiful. Well, go check out Pick the Lock by A.S. King. And Amy will put in the show notes the best place for people to purchase that book or read more about it and get a sense of it. I read all the Goodreads reviews and they were really fun. So will make people want to read it for sure. But thank you for coming and telling us about the place where you are and how you're getting through it, and just how you're doing this thing, having a writing career. I appreciate it so much.
I appreciate you having me. I appreciate what you do. I appreciate the writers you work with, and it must be such an expanse of people you work with. But isn't it funny that advice holds true no matter what genre you're writing, no matter what you're doing, right? The person I was talking to, the nonfiction writer, I'm like, go write an essay, man. You're really good at it.
Yeah, do something. That's really what it comes down to. Just even with the publicity, right? Just do something. If everything gets pulled out from under you like it did for you, do what you can do. Do something.
Exactly. Well, thank you so much. I appreciate you.
I appreciate you. And I have to say the words, which we say at the end of our podcast, which is keep your butt in the chair and your head in the game.
The Hashtag Am Writing podcast is produced by Andrew Perella. Our intro music, aptly titled Unemployed Monday, was written and played by Max Cohen. Andrew and Max were paid for their time and their creative output because everyone deserves to be paid for their work.
Save, pause, stop.